It is June 23rd at 11:10 in Frankfort. We're interviewing Dr. Stephen Stack. I'm Mandy Higgins with the Kentucky Historical Society. If you can just state your name.
My name is Stephen Stack, and I'm the Commissioner for Public Health.
Thank you. How did you join the administration?
So I'd had a wonderful career as an emergency physician and also as an administrator for emergency departments, and additionally in organized medicine, and I became the president of the American Medical Association in 2015. I had hoped I'd have a chance in my career to have a period of government service and to see what it was like to serve on the other side of the desk rather than just petitioning people in government. And when Governor Beshear got elected in November of 2019, that became a potential opportunity to serve. And so I submitted an application just like other people on the transition website, and was pleasantly surprised to get a call for an interview. And after a couple interviews, I was offered this post. Ironically, that was on January 7th when I was offered the position, and I began on February 10th. When I was offered the job, it was not clear what was happening in China. It was just beginning. By the time I showed up on February 10th, it was very clear there was a global pandemic unfolding. And just a month later, we had our first patient. So that began my journey, but that's how I got into government.
Yeah. What did you expect you would be doing when you accepted the job on January 7th?
So the Department for Public Health is a fascinating department, even without COVID. So we have seven divisions that does everything from a high-complexity reference laboratory. So we do all the public health testing for all 53,000 newborns in the state have all their screening testing done there for inborn errors of metabolism. We're the only lab in the state that tests for white powders, biohazardous materials like anthrax and bio-threat materials, and a number of other things we do. We also, though, do women's health, where we do cervical and breast cancer prevention programs, colon cancer screening programs. Lung cancer now has recently been given some funding for us to do screening for lung cancer. We run programs that inspect pools through our local health department partners, pools, restaurants, food manufacturing, number septic systems, a whole number of other things. And of course, we do disease surveillance, which is what COVID really brought to the forefront. We do emergency response when there's tornadoes and floods and ice storms. And of course, COVID became a natural disaster in its own right. So we do a whole wide array of things that are really, really quite fascinating, including early childhood interventions, where we go and help support mothers who are having their first or second children to try to help with parenting skills and provide support for them. So I had hoped and thought that I would be getting immersed in programs like that. And in fact, those programs continue to operate throughout the pandemic. But for me, my journey will forever be identified as being related to the pandemic, because that essentially drowned out for me just about everything else for about a year and a half or 2 years after it started getting going in March.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that when you accepted the job in January, it wasn't very clear what was happening, but by the time you started in February, it was. So how did you learn about the virus and the sort of what was happening in that interim?
Right, so in January, all I had access to is what was in the popular media, and it really was not that much. It was, we think something's happening, and there could be this mysterious illness in China. By the time I became the health commissioner, the news coverage was increasing, because it was now impacting or starting to impact Europe, where there was more information available. And then once I became the health commissioner, I became one person as a member of a community nationwide who are state health officials. So as commissioner for public health in Kentucky, I am the designated state health official, and that has meaning nationally. So I and others from 49 other states and the territories engaged through an organization called the Association for State and Territorial Health Officials, or ASHTO. And I started attending meetings, virtual meetings, telephone meetings with this group. They later then changed to Zoom meetings and started learning from them. And then the last airplane trip I took was before the pandemic in late February, was to Washington, D.C., where we were there with state health officials, and we were brought into the White House grounds and given a briefing by senior administration officials about what they understood and what was going on at that time. And then I didn't go on an airplane or go anywhere until May of this year.
Oh, wow.
At least out of the state, through domestic air travel. So it was quite the journey. But we have a very rich dialogue and collaboration across the state health officials around the country. And we work closely with our federal partners at the federal agencies. And, of course, here in the state itself, we have 120 counties served by 61 local health departments. And we had lots and lots of interactions and discussions with the public health directors for the counties. And I would just want to make sure people know how grateful I am to all those local health leaders, because they really are the principal health strategists for their communities. And they are deeply, deeply committed to the health and wellness of the people they serve. And it's been a privilege to serve with them.
Can you take me back to that March 6th day and the feelings of having to announce this first case of communicating this to the public?
Yeah, you know, feelings might be a little bit more challenging. At that point, when we identified our first patient in Kentucky, it was only the first one we found. Mm-hmm. It probably was not the first one out there. And it was a landmark moment because it was the first one we had confirmed and could announce. But we really had no idea how long this would go on for or what the outlook would be. So my recollection of that is more of just uncertainty. Remember, I had not really done a press conference with the governor before. And so we all showed up there in suits and ties and very formal. And if you look back at those video clips and you look at the evolution over time, it's just like a favorite television show you'd watch, where the cast and the characters don't have the chemistry in the first few episodes, but if you watch 3-4 seasons later, mm-hmm. they're like, you know, well-worn friends and everyone knows each other.
Yeah.
So you can watch that transformation over the course of the time I've had the privilege to work with the governor and the cabinet secretary. I just remember a lot of uncertainty and novelty, trying to learn my job. Remember, I didn't know my team or the agency. I didn't know how all these public health systems worked, at least not from inside the government. So it was a very, very steep learning curve. But again, there were so many wonderful people who were involved in the Department for Public Health that we could draw on that resource of knowledge and experience and hopefully get through this pretty well.
Did you get any training, or was it just, hey, go talk into this microphone?
Well, there's an irony here, and I've told this story repeatedly. So on my first day in the office, which is February 10th, I shared with my senior team, you know, that it was a privilege to be there and I'd be happy to do whatever the job required. But if I could have one preference, I'd prefer not to seek out media opportunities. And they didn't know me, you know, and there's an irony, right? So be careful. I got retribution, I guess, or payback, because that's what I got in spades, was media opportunities. But I'd been trained through the American Medical Association in my career before. So it wasn't because I was unfamiliar with it. It was just that I really wanted to focus on public health very specifically, helping to support the team, helping to address problems that had been long neglected, and help to unleash their full potential to do good things for people in Kentucky. It was not about, for me, getting in front of TV cameras or talking to public outlets. I wanted other people to have that chance and to showcase their good work and their abilities. So, but I'd had plenty of training before, and hopefully in some small measure that came across, but when I started to get relaxed into the role and just get down to doing the work.
Yeah, I am a Kentuckian, and it did come across. So it is there. Can you tell me about the development of the branding of Team Kentucky and having that as a sort of rallying cry within those early moments of the media and the press conferences?
Yeah, so one of the great joys and privileges of what I get to do is I get to be an advisor to the governor and his team. One of the other things is I am but one advisor. So I can take no credit for and actually don't know the origin story for Team Kentucky specifically. But I certainly can speak to what it meant to myself and what I observed along the journey. So we said early on, and the governor, of course, one of his catchphrases became very clearly, we'll get through this, we'll get through this together. But those words have meaning, and they're powerful, particularly when people hear them repeatedly and in a calm, reassuring manner. Because for a lot of people, for a whole lot of people, this is a very terrifying moment because we had no idea what was coming. We had no idea how badly people could get hurt or how many would get hurt. And it felt very disempowering, like there was very little people could do to act. And I think one of the obligations of people in positions of authority or leadership is that you have to paint for people a picture of a future that is better and a path that we can get there, a credible path. What can I do to be part of making that happen? And I think the governor did a really wonderful job when he very early on said, we'll get through this together. And I hope in my own way, people heard me say repeatedly, my approach was to remind people to be kind and caring to other people and look out for each other and be patient with each other and tolerant, you know, as we go through all these difficult times because a lot of people were hurting. And so I think in our different ways, we conveyed that similar message. And I think there were two different ways of many, many ways to convey that Team Kentucky concept. And really it is together we're stronger and together we can achieve more. And I think we showed that.
Can you describe some of your emotions in briefing the state and trying to portray that message?
Yeah, and it really was quite the journey because it became very regular. I mean, there were months where we were on television doing those briefings, so much so that you're well aware, probably yourself or your mm-hmm. friends and family had bourbon or beer with Bashir at 5, right? Mm-hmm. So it became the thing for people to do when they couldn't do all their other activities. And along the way, one of the things that was quite the experience for me, because I never expected to lose my anonymity when I took this job. How many health commissioners can you name before Steve Stack, right? So there's
zero.
Yeah, it's not a job that generally has very high public visibility. Mm-hmm. That's what I sort of thought I was signing up for, and it became exactly the opposite of that. And so I have a whole Tupperware container full of handwritten notes from people all over the state. The governor gets a lot more mail than I do, but I also got people sent me things like rosaries and note cards. People noticed that I would bring a blue notebook sometimes to the press conferences as a way to jot my notes down. And one person noticed that I was almost out of my notebook, and so he had a very nicely leather-bound notebook that he had written his name in the front. He erased his name out, and he said he hadn't started using this one yet, but saw that I was almost out and thought I would need it more. So I had all these little unexpected acts of kindness. And so, but the other thing was people saw when I got tired or exhausted and you could see the frustration. Hopefully those things bottled up and maintained in a professional way. But I think we need more people who are willing to allow some of the difficulties and some of the strains to show in order for others to know that that's normal, that that's okay. It's okay that things are hard, and it's okay to admit that they're hard. And I think we did that while hopefully also being able to convey calm confidence and that we weren't powerless to influence the world as we saw it.
Yeah. I vividly remember the day that you cried behind the podium.
Yeah.
Do you mind talking a little bit about that?
No. It's not been my strong suit about not having emotional moments, unfortunately. You can tell, though, and this is what gets scary, is because scary in a vulnerable way. People could start to understand you in ways that you wouldn't have expected for strangers around the state. So I tend to get emotional at moments of people really rising to the challenge and being at their best. Moments where people have the unexpected calamities that strike them. I mean, there's just fundamental human sadnesses that sort of happen. And I think you saw that at times. I also wanted people to understand, because we all perceive the world differently, this was never about trying to save every single person, because that's an impossible goal. There were really, really big uncertainties and really scary things that could have happened, and some that did. And there's over 16,000 Kentuckians who have died due to COVID as we sit and talk here now. Mm-hmm. That's substantial. And there are thousands of additional people who have passed from COVID who, when you look at our historical death rates for the state, are additional deaths above and beyond what our normal baseline mortality rate is. So COVID has really hit a lot of families hard in the state. And those are just the people who have died. Think about all the people who got sick, who missed weeks or months from work, and the people who had the long illness that are still we're still learning about. So when I would get up there and communicate, you wanted to try to convey, at least I wanted to try to convey to people, that we were aware that there were difficult trade-offs. People's businesses were hurting. It's very hard to run a business when you have to all be 6 feet apart inside of it. I appreciate that. The flip side, though, was that in the early days, there was a very, very real and credible risk that as much as 1 to 2% of an entire population could die if the disease just ran unchecked through it. If you use those numbers, I told you we have over 16,000 deaths. You're talking 45,000 to 90,000 potential deaths. And those were credible numbers based on what we knew at the time. And as our evolution of our knowledge and learning improved, as we got finally access to masks, as we finally had access to testing, as we eventually had access to vaccines and other treatments, and then there was more immunity in the population and the virus finally became a little less dangerous. But that circumstance changed. But in the early days, none of that was true. And so we had to find a way to try to convey to the public why it was serious and why these other sacrifices were necessary from so many people. And we give us incomplete success on that because it's really never possible to fully get through. But from what I get, I still get people come up to me, strangers in public, and say thank you. It appears that we managed to get through to quite a few people. You don't have to know the answers all the time, but you should at least be able to be honest with folks and be straight and not scare the heck out of them at the same time, so that they don't feel like they are completely powerless to try to chart a course that leads them to safety.
You mentioned you didn't expect to lose your anonymity. What is it like to be a minor celebrity in Kentucky?
I should be careful who I use as comparators, but it's like being Bill Nye the Science Guy in Kentucky, right? So it is really a privilege, but it's also really different. Now I can go out to restaurants. I'm very grateful for that. I said earlier on, the hospitality industry really took it hard because of the social distancing that was required for the earlier part of the pandemic. I love traveling. I love going out to restaurants. There are restaurants where we are regulars and people know us there. So it was particularly painful to have to take steps that we knew were very, very difficult for an industry that we had long supported and enjoyed. Now I go into restaurants and I get hands down people who come up and say thank you and have unexpectedly paid for a part of the dinner, and usually they do that and they leave, and then the waitress says, hey, that couple that was sitting back there picked up this part of the thing and just said to tell you what they said, thank you. And so those kinds of random acts of generosity mean a lot, and those were the kind of things, as you can tell now, as I get where I would get emotional at those press conferences, is where it was really, really hard, but people could understand it was hard and understand that sometimes we just get dealt a hand we don't want to play, but our choice is to play the hand or to walk away, and walking away was just not an option. So as I go around now, I will tell you, overwhelmingly people come up and say thank you. I get caught off guard at the grocery store, at Target, if I go to restaurants, like I've said. Now, if I leave the state of Kentucky, I'm gloriously, no one knows who the heck I am and they don't care. But I've traveled a lot now through Kentucky. I've been to half the counties and 51 of the 61 health departments. And so that's all over the state. And I have yet to find a place where if I walk into a public place, someone doesn't recognize me. And more often than not, it's my voice that gives it away. So this happened yesterday. I was at an event and I don't think the individual recognized me. And then they said something and I responded. And then he said, where do I know you from? My voice, apparently because of all the TV and radio, people really recognize that.
Mm-hmm. How did that change affect your family?
Yeah, so one of the things, I generally don't bring my family up all that much because this is a journey that I'm grateful that they support me for. but it's also a journey that is uniquely something I do. They've always been supportive. My wife knew who she married, and I'm very grateful to her because she's known that for a career. I mean, when I was the president of the American Medical Association, I traveled about 180 days a year for a couple years outside of the state, and then came back and worked in the emergency department when I wasn't doing that. So there were quite a lot of a long stretch where I was away doing work. My daughter is, who's turned into a wonderful young adult, has been wonderful about this, and so we have quality time in other ways, but a lot of times I wasn't present because I was traveling. Well, when I got this job, at least I was home in my own bed every night, so I didn't go anywhere outside the state for 2 years or more. But I was seldom home because I came to the office before the sun came up and left after the sun went down usually. So they were very, very long days, and it required them to get used to that. But then again, it was a time when everyone in society was going through so much change and difficulty. So I think that probably helped in a weird way with us, because everyone was having their life upended. And so whatever we were experiencing was hardly exceptional compared to what other people had to go through.
What were the reactions to masking and mask wearing? Did they catch you off guard? How did that start?
So I've said this at press conferences, you know, I love reading history. So I studied Latin and Greek, you know, in high school and in college, and I read history books for fun. And so parts of it weren't a shock at all. I mean, history may not repeat, but it certainly does rhyme. Mm-hmm. And this all happened in the 1918 influenza pandemic. People argued over whether they should wear masks or not. You can see pictures of people in cotton masks. People argued about shutting down businesses and argued about what interventions were appropriate or not. There was very little about the human behavior of this that was a surprise. So that's why messaging is so important early on, is you need to try to get people to see that we will either all hang together or we're all hang separately, mm-hmm. and it'll be worse if we hang separately. So it's better if we bind together and share a common purpose. I think that became unfortunately more difficult more quickly than it needed to, because there was obviously other politicization that went on, and that's an unfortunate that's an unfortunate reality. But if you read Shakespeare, if you read Homer, I mean, this is stuff that humanity has been doing for a very, very long time. So I don't think that was a surprise. It's just the fact that it's not a surprise doesn't make it disappointing each novel time that it happens. But we did, I think, fairly well in Kentucky. And I will tell you, I had the opportunity over that long journey to interact with college and university presidents, with all the health department leaders, with CEOs and chief medical officers and other leaders at all the hospitals across the state. At times with judge executives and mayors, emergency response professionals from across the state, I have a wonderful deputy commissioner who has did a lot of the work with the K-12 community, but I would periodically appear to talk with the school superintendents. We talked with just about every stripe of society, and I just want people to know I can't really recall a time when anyone ever made it a Democrat or Republican issue. Very, very rarely did the rural or urban issue came up. And usually when it did, it was understandable. It was just the difficulty of scarcity, mm-hmm. and everybody wasn't getting enough. But then people tend to view it from their own lens. And so is it somehow I'm being disadvantaged because I'm in this setting versus that? But my memories overwhelmingly and just solidly are of people coming together, trying to deal with difficult problems, and people pulled together. And so I think we showed in Kentucky that even our state's as politically divided as anyone out there, that even in that setting and situation, you can get people to come together if you can help frame it in a way that helps people to have a safe way and a safe space to work together and overcome things that are otherwise pretty minor.
You mentioned that people would send you gifts and things. Did that start after the push for folks to make cotton masks, or did that start immediately?
I don't remember exactly when it started, but it certainly started at least a few weeks after those press conferences really got going. Mm-hmm. So I don't remember when the governor flipped over to the daily briefings. I know we did daily, and then at some point it clearly just became daily and stayed daily for mm-hmm. a while. But it was once that really hit a cadence that then people started writing and communicating. Sometimes they'd send a letter to the governor's office who'd pass it on to me. Sometimes they'd send it to me at the public health office. But, and again, the gifts were usually things that were handmade or that were thoughtful, you know, from them. I got rosaries. People sent me, this was on TV, one day I showed up, I hadn't worn a tie to work. And someone mailed me a wooden bow tie, and they had made in their shop, and I wore that to the press conference, and I gave a shout out. It's the closest I'll ever come to being like Oprah, and they had people calling and ordering. They were donating a portion of their proceeds to support healthcare workers and first responders, and so I wore that at the press conference, and I think someone said in the shop they had a sign that said something along the lines as seen worn by Dr. Stack on TV. So those things were nice because I think people could feel that there was a connection. And the governor, you notice he had a cup. He always had a cup of water up there because mm-hmm. these conferences would go on for like an hour, so he'd have some water with him. And then people started sending him cups, so the cups started to change mm-hmm. on a regular basis. And someone machined one of those cups for me, you know, too. So most of these things are nicely adorning my office where people, when they come in, can see them. But it was more the thought that really counted and the sentiments that they wrote in their notes.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about, and it can be big picture, but what those sentiments were that folks were sharing with you?
Yeah. So overwhelmingly, you know, 98% plus were gratitude, appreciation. When you asked about losing my anonymity, I mean, when people would say, you look tired at that last press conference, I hope you're taking time to get yourself some rest and stuff, you know. And they were right. And so that's a little freaky when people start to get to know you in a way and they're actually right. Or and I was like, did I look that bad? Like, I didn't realize I looked that bad that day. So it's a real weird journey when that happens. There were the occasional, and there really weren't many, but there was the occasional note where someone raised a concern or expressed a frustration. Now, earlier on, I was so busy with the work, I just didn't have anything left to be able to write back to all these people. But as things went on and we got some stability in some of our approach to some of the bigger problems, then I would try to start to write back. And so there should be quite a few people around the state who have a note card where I wrote back and at least thanked them for reaching out to me. And I don't have anyone doing that for me. So when they were handwritten by me, they were handwritten by me. So it was nice to be able to do that. And then I occasionally got some recurring writers. One person who's associated with the high school where my daughter goes, I got pretty much every other week I got a note card from that individual. And there's another one who wrote me, and I recognized the name, so I wrote back, it's nice to hear from you again. Mm-hmm. And so now that person writes me on a regular, periodic basis. So, you know, for some of those individuals, hopefully that has had meaning for them. It certainly is helpful to people doing jobs like I was doing and am doing, because it helps you know you've connected and that people see some value, and in some way it helped them to get through a hard time.
Yeah. You brought a gift today. Can you describe it for us?
So one of the things you had mentioned before I came here was that the quilt makers. And so the quilt makers sent, and I believe the governor has one that's similar to this, but yeah, so I brought this note card. So the quilt makers made a quilt, which you showed me here earlier, and was available for display, and it kind of captured the COVID journey. And then they had some leftover quilt squares, and they made teddy bears out of it. And so they sent me this teddy bear, and on the teddy bear is hanging a mask that I could take off and wear that has the governor's hallmark phrase, "We'll get through this, we'll get through this together." And then the teddy bear's wearing its own mask and a bow tie. One little side story about that. Do you associate me with a bow tie?
I don't, actually.
Okay, well, that's good. So I didn't wear lots of bow ties, but I was wearing, obviously we were in suits the first couple mm-hmm. weeks at all these press conferences, and my wife's friends commented that I had a number of nice ties, and so I figured, well, if people are noticing my ties, I'll wear a bow tie mm-hmm. and see where that goes. So I wore a bow tie, and then that kind of became a hallmark. And it's because obviously not a lot of people wear bow ties. So apparently my American Sign Language sign in the state is Dr. Bowtie, where you cross your fingers in front. So Virginia, I think, coined that. So I'm Dr. Bowtie. So if you ever watch a press conference where Virginia's signing for me, look up and you'll see when she introduces me, she'll cross her fingers in front of her throat like a bow tie, and I'm Dr. Bowtie. So anyway, back to the teddy bear I have here. So the Kentucky Quilt Makers group sent me this teddy bear that they call Doc. And she wrote me a nice little note in here and a story about Doc being a healthcare hero. And so most of these gifts I have in my office here in Frankfurt on display. This is one that I've taken home with me, and it sits on my bookshelf at home. So these little things go a long way, and they mean a lot to people who are doing things like I'm doing. So I'm very grateful to Regina and the rest of the group who sent this to me.
You brought up Virginia. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of having an interpreter and the inclusion that brought to your all's press conferences?
Yeah, so again, the governor, I think Governor Beshear, this is very noteworthy and praiseworthy for him to do this. It was important for him to make sure that people had access to information and they could know what was going on as best we were able to tell them and feel the comfort in that knowledge in some way. And so it was second nature. I can't remember a time where we were there that there wasn't a sign interpreter. In fact, I've never been through this kind of journey before, so I would have assumed that was more normal than not, and apparently it is not. And so that was a commitment he has made and maintained throughout the entire journey, so much so that people associated, you know, the governor in Virginia and then me, and then, of course, there were some others. Mm-hmm. Kenneth was in there. Which poor Kenneth got the rap because he was always the one, if there was a technical problem that didn't go out quite right, they call him out. But so it was quite the journey. But no, Virginia and the rest of her colleagues are always there, and I'm grateful for that. And they're an invaluable part of the team to make sure that we're reaching and communicating with people who might otherwise have difficulty.
You mentioned highlighting some of these gifts in the briefings. Why? Well, why was that important?
It's a connection to the people that we were trying to serve. And I think what happens over time is when, and this is my approach to communication. I generally don't like rigid, stilted set speeches. I generally like to engage with the people I'm talking with. It's harder to engage with people through a camera lens at a distance, but those things help to show connection. And they were meaningful to me. So getting that bow tie was a nice treat. There were two women, I don't remember their names, there were two women who sent me a different bow tie, a real bow tie, and it was a medical one. It had hypodermic needles on it and a stethoscope or things like that. I wore that to a press conference one day. But I think people just wanted to let folks like me know that they were listening, that they were appreciative, that they cared, that they saw that it was a difficult journey, and that meant a lot. And so when I could show back that their gifts actually got through, because I think a lot of times people who have sent those notes or thoughts of kindness, they might never know if they reach the intended audience and just feel it disappears into a black box. Mm-hmm. I think people have frustration. They feel their government's not responsive to them, that nobody listens. And then we create, of course, all of us, the worst possible narrative, that they're all incompetent, that they don't care, nobody's really listening to us, they're in it for themselves. And in some small way, hopefully seeing some of those things and those moments that were not just about the science, but also about the human aspect, help people in a way to get a sense that there are a lot of people who care, and a lot of those people are working in their state government. And I get to go out and be this very prominent person telling these stories like I am now. But really, it's all the hundreds, and in fact, there's probably 3,000 or more public health workers throughout the Commonwealth supporting 4.5 million people. It's a small workforce, but it's a mighty and powerful workforce. All those people are the real heroes who should be celebrated. So if in some small way me getting out and telling these stories helps people to appreciate, no, there's really a lot of good people in your state and local government really working hard trying to make sure we keep you safe and allow you to do what you want to do to have a full and healthy and happy life. I think that those connections to the people, when I could show some of those things, hopefully helped to make that more real.
How did your colleagues respond to sort of...
Which colleagues?
Your public health colleagues respond.
Well, you know, that'd be a good thing to ask some of them. they'd never seen, I don't think. I mean, none of us had seen mm-hmm. something like this. None of us alive. No human being alive has been... Because the last time that something this big like this happened was 1918. Mm-hmm. But very few humans, I shouldn't say no human alive, but very few humans alive had been through anything like this. So... I don't know for sure, but I think it did help them because they could see a governor who had a science advisor at his side, who listened to a science advisor, who empowered his public health advisor to have a meaningful and impactful role. And they could see that we were guided by science, guided by the best evidence we had, and that when the evidence changed, we got up and said, hey, things have changed, and here's why. And here's what we have to do in response to the new things we've learned or the new things we understand. And so I think that helped really empower them in a way, because they could feel that when they met with me and we were talking, that if we came up with an agreement or a proposal or something that we felt should be done in the greater good for the state, that there was a pretty good chance that advice would be able to reach the governor, that the governor would take it in the context of the broader advice he has to work with and make the best decision that he could. And so I think it hopefully helped to have them feel empowered and supported. And the governor certainly supported public health. Not every other state was as supportive for public health as Governor Beshear was here in Kentucky. And I think that made a big difference, and we're grateful for it.
Yeah. In that same vein, can you tell me about the first days of the vaccine being available?
Yeah, no, first of all, we got to put this in context. The COVID-19 vaccine is really a modern medical miracle. I mean, to have a new vaccine developed and available for use in less than 12 months is heroic. And I can't remember now, it was the mumps vaccine, what before that was the most rapidly developed vaccine, and it took 4 or more years, and it could have been substantially longer, but I know it took at least 4 years. So that was lightning fast. Now, we were fortunate because the technology that was used for the mRNA vaccines apparently was just on the cusp of being ready to be used for other purposes, and this provided the urgency to go through that last part of the journey. The stories, and I didn't get to go see these personally, but the stories at the beginning of people showing up at vaccine sites and crying to get vaccinated just are really heartwarming and heart-wrenching at times, because people were living in fear. I mean, if you were someone who was a senior citizen, you had every legitimate and credible reason to be fearful that this disease could wipe you out. And so people probably stayed in very intense isolation trying to avoid exposure. And the vaccine offered the hope that they... in addition to the measures they could take for themselves, that this might give them that protection. And in fact, it has. The data has been very compelling about how incredibly protective the vaccines are for mortality and severe illness. And that's held up over time. For me, is the state health official working with our public health team in the midst of a lot of difficult things. Boy, that was a difficult thing, because the vaccine was available in very small quantities at the beginning. It had to be stored in special freezers that could go to minus 60 or minus 80 degrees Celsius, which is really cold. Very few places in the state had those freezers. And then for whatever reason, it must have been someone at the factory only had a certain number of bottles, a certain size, or the machines were built a certain way, because they got shipped in quantities of 1,170 for the one vaccine. You're like, well, if you're only going to get 9 trays of 1,170, and they can only be stored in freezers of a really special type that are not really widely available, it was really hard to distribute those. And so people were frustrated. Well, why can't we get 70 doses here or 100 doses here? It's because it doesn't divide that way. Mm-hmm. And so it was really intense and frustrating in the early months, because people at the early stages were crying out to have access to the vaccine, and it just wasn't enough to go around, and we couldn't get it everywhere because there was both so little and it required such extreme storage and handling. And of course, now we've gone the full journey. Now we're at the other side, where if the first 20% were eager early adopters who were enraged because they couldn't get the vaccine fast enough, now there's the last 20 or 25% mm-hmm. who are saying, you stay away from me, I don't want that. Mm-hmm. So, but again, that's predictable in human history too. We've seen this in other circumstances. So it's been quite the journey. But in the beginning, it was very intense for our team because it was a lot of complex logistics. Mm-hmm. And we had one vaccine, and the next week we had the next vaccine, and then a few months later we had a third vaccine. We had to become sort of like complex logistics experts for how to allocate and get distributed a very scarce resource. And so that, it's in hindsight, an incredible success to have pulled off what was pulled off nationwide and here in Kentucky. But yeah, it was pretty tiring and difficult. Yeah.
Did you attend any of the mass vaccination sites or any, were you ever in one?
Yeah, so I went to the one at UK Kroger Field, mm-hmm. and I saw a couple others from a distance. My approach, though, generally was, for quite a while, my life was confined to going between my house and my office or the press room. It was just not a good idea to be out in public. One, so that I didn't get infected and expose people, but also it's very important to model the behavior you're asking others to do. And so I didn't want to go out and ever appear to not be following the guidance we were recommending for others. I also didn't want to take the chance that someone who might be particularly upset, because everyone is a journalist now with their smartphones, mm-hmm. Would take pictures from an awkward angle, and it made it look like I was doing something I shouldn't. So quite frankly, the easiest way to avoid that was just not to go out in public. So I would have liked to have gone out and done more stuff, but it just wasn't tenable at the time.
Yeah. What have you learned about Kentucky and Kentuckians over this journey?
Well, it saddens me to see just how easily we argue over relatively minor things, and how intensely and passionately we have conflict with each other over things that are important, but where we shouldn't have such hostility. Because when I travel around the state, and I crawl around in a car, I mean, I don't fly around to places, I drive around to places, people have just been very kind and very wonderful. And we've got to find a way as a society, and this is where individuals need to realize that it doesn't feel like it in the moment, but your individual actions have great importance to all of us. Because how we choose to treat someone, how we choose to interact with someone, whether we choose to listen to people who disagree with us or see the world differently, or whether we just discount them as a nut job, or whether we label people. We shouldn't really label people, because once you label people, you start defining me versus them or us versus them, and then you insert distance. So when you don't call someone by their name, or when you don't describe what the actual concepts you're talking about, you give it a label or a tag, and then you attack the tag, it distances things, and it makes it easy to become particularly cruel and a very dangerous and slippery slope, while losing sight of the fact that that would not normally be behavior that our parents raised us to mm-hmm. find acceptable. So we all have to do better about that, or we're going to face other consequences for society that history has also shown us before, and they're not good. So what I learned is that there's just a wonderful richness of the culture throughout Kentucky, and it's a diversity of culture. If I go to Western Kentucky or Central Kentucky or Eastern Kentucky and Appalachia, the stories are different, the dialects are different. The traditions are different. There's pride. There's pride in people's culture and their family. There's a desire to feel good about themselves and what their communities represent and who they are. And that's just wonderful to see. We just got to find a way to focus more stories on some of that wonderfulness and a little bit less on all the negativity that's out there, because I mean, that goodness is still there, but we need something to unite us to focus on that more.
And last question I've asked everyone we've interviewed for this series. How are you feeling today? It's June 23rd, 22.
Today I feel much better. COVID was for me what it was for many others, right? I gained weight. I didn't go to exercise. It was stressful because we were having to make all these decisions and try to address all these problems. It was isolating. I mean, I had the same, I worked with people all the time, but friends that I normally would see at conferences around the country multiple times a year, or friends that we would get together for social stuff, we didn't do those social activities. So it was isolating, and it was hard. And I think we saw, I mean, I have a high school child, you know, so she was doing home, you know, teleschooling just like everybody, the other kids of her age. So we got to see what that was like. My wife is a practicing physician, you know, so she had to go through with patients the difficulties of navigating the healthcare system when it was in a weird time. So those were very, very hard. But when you ask how I am today, I'm much better because I can go out to a restaurant and see people. I can smile at people. People can see my face and I can see theirs. I can still be responsible. I was at a service yesterday remembering someone who passed recently. I could still wear a mask if I needed to, but I could at a distance or make reasonable judgment about when I could take it off. Those things all have made it better now, and now I can go back to the gym and take the weight back off and get back in shape. And so, and I've traveled a little bit more now because I'm able to. And so I feel much better now. But, you know, I wouldn't trade the journey. The journey was what it was, and it was a privilege to serve during that time of difficulty and to do something really meaningful. I know today is much better than it was this time last year or a year or 2 years ago.
Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity to be here.